The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. This is the Hervoy Moritz Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Happy Taco Tuesday or Wacky Wednesday for the Aussies and New Zealanders and Pacific Islanders out there. Anyone listening in from Japan or those parts of the realm, my hashtag for today is let's get this party started. U.S. nuclear bomber catches fire after emergency landing. The B-2 Spirit was forced to touch down in Missouri after experiencing an in-flight malfunction. Not good. In-flight malfunction that could have easily gone bad. So there's that. And then let's get this party started. The Biden administration is finalizing plans to send the Patriot missile defense system to Ukraine that could be announced as soon as this week, according to U.S. officials and senior admin official. Ukraine has been calling for the U.S. to send the advanced long-range air defense system that is highly effective at intercepting ballistic and cruise missiles as it comes under a barrage of Russian missile and drone attacks that have destroyed infrastructure. Let's get this party started. How about China? China sent a record 18 nuclear-capable bombers into Taiwan's air defense zone today. Just days after Beijing banned more Taiwanese imports in the latest sign of deteriorating ties. What could I say? Let's get this party started. I'm being silly here, but one more. The UK has officially admitted it sent troops to Ukraine. The Royal Marines have been taking part in discrete operations several months into the conflict. British Royal Marines conducted high-risk ops in Ukraine in April. Russian claims that this was the case were initially dismissed by Western analysts and media. So, let's get this party started. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I'm just being silly because it's all just so crazy. I mean, I can't stay sane otherwise. I have to joke around, you know, make jokes. And so, yeah, BitChute, which I use, apparently their money has been stolen by HSBC. I think they put out an announcement today. They've started a Give, Send, Go. So basically they say that they had a new bank, which it says the new bank rejected us just as the funds had reached them. Our money was returned to HSBC, but we can no longer access it. And even today, we still have not retrieved our money from HSBC. They had an arbitration. And then basically their bank account was suspended without notice. They've not been able to get their money from the bank. And so it's been held up for almost 2 years by HSBC. So that's not cool. So they say, build your own platform. You got to build your own everything. I mean, I'm sure if you built your own bank, the government would just come and take it at this point. So you can't build anything anymore. It's nuts. And in India, Indian citizens that don't link bank account numbers to digital ID will soon face financial blacklisting. The algorithm ghetto is on the march. It's advancing at warp speed. India's Income Tax Administration has warned citizens that they should link their PAN, their permanent account number, to their biometric identification number before April or risk their PAN becoming non-operational. That's something that's the PAN is required to carry out financial activities like creating bank accounts, depositing money, trading stocks, buying or selling real estate. So basically, if you don't link, we have something similar like that in Mexico as well. And so if you don't link it to your digital ID, you can't buy or sell. You can't buy or sell without the mark of the beast. It's really, we are, as I was saying earlier today with Fauci, saying that we're still in the middle of the pandemic. I'm like, we're so far in tyrannical clown world territory. I've got nothing else to say. Just like that old Soundgarden song, nothing to say. It should all be evident. This craziness, I still can't believe people can't see what's going on. They're just walking right into the electronic concentration camp. Reminder, we got our live chat. You can chat. Someone left the last comment. Would you like one hump or two with your camel virus? I was talking about that yesterday, the camel virus. Reminder that you don't have to miss any interviews or shows here on TNT. You can always listen back to the complete archive. Every single TNT Radio interview that was ever done is available at tntradio.live or on the podcast platforms, Apple, Google, Spotify, yada, yada. You have no reason to miss anything on TNT Radio.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
On October 23rd, 2022. So just recently, I don't know how we missed this. Someone had just posted this in the media earlier, I think this week or late last week. But this past October, the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security was added again, along with the WHO and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They conducted a pandemic tabletop exercise involving a fictional pandemic set in the near future. Now, wait just a minute. Haven't we heard all this before? Isn't this just a rerun of Event 201 or something far worse? And Event 201 was also held, if I recall, October of 2019. So 3 years later, here we are. Here to discuss, joining me now is TNT Radio news producer, co-host of Joseph Arthur's Technicolor Dreamcast, Adam Ruckus-Clark.
Thanks, Hervory. As you say, let's get this party started, shall we? And what's a party without a good tabletop game, right? I mean, holy moly. I swear, when I heard this news, I thought they literally took the announcement from Event 201 and just like copy and pasted it and replaced the dates. I thought it was a joke, actually. The first time I saw it, I thought, okay, this isn't even real. This cannot be happening. Just to bring everybody up to speed, just so you can understand how exactly eerily, incredibly eerily similar this is to the Event 201, let's start there, shall we? When that happened, the official announcement was, and I'm quoting, "The Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, in partnership with the World Economic Forum and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, hosted Event 201, a high-level pandemic exercise, on October 18th, 2019, in New York, New York. The exercise illustrated areas where public-private partnerships will be necessary during the response to a severe pandemic in order to diminish large-scale economic and societal consequences. Event 201 simulates, past tense now, simulated an outbreak of a novel zoonotic coronavirus transmitted from bats to pigs to people that eventually becomes efficiently transmissible from person to person, leading to a severe pandemic. The pathogen and the disease it causes are modeled largely on SARS, but it is more transmissible in the community setting by people with mild symptoms." So keep all of that in mind, okay? All right, now here's the new one, official announcement. By the way, you're gonna love the name of this one. And I'm quoting, "The Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, in partnership with the World Health Organization this time, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, conducted Catastrophic Contagion, a pandemic tabletop exercise at the Grand Challenges annual meeting in Brussels, Belgium on October 23rd, 2022. There's October again. The extraordinary group of participants consisted of 10 current and former health ministers and senior public health officials from Senegal, Rwanda, Nigeria, Angola, Liberia, Singapore, India, Germany, as well as, yep, Mr. Bill Gates himself, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Applause, yay. Party. The exercise simulated a series of World Health Organization Emergency Health Advisory Board meetings addressing a fictional pandemic set in the near future. Participants grappled with how to respond to an epidemic located in one part of the world that then spread rapidly, becoming a pandemic with a higher fatality rate than COVID-19, that's not hard to do, and disproportionately affecting children and young people. And that is where I start to get very worried. Why should we all be concerned about any of this? Well, you know, going back to event 201, keeping in mind that basically they predicted an enterovirus originating in Brazil that dealt with basically lockdowns, masking, vaccine passports, and social distancing, which are things that we all had to deal with in real life when the COVID-19 pandemic broke out, which they also, if I'm not mistaken, tried to link back to bats, if I'm not mistaken. Of course, it came from China rather than Brazil as presented in the fictional setting. But hey, that's pretty darn close there. Bill Gates is known for doing this kind of stuff, Rory. Not only did they pretty much nail it with Event 201, I kind of forgot about this. It kind of passed by under the radar, but they also did something similar where they basically predicted monkeypox. I guess there was this other simulation, not from these exact same people, but Bill Gates was involved, and it simulated a start date of a pandemic involving monkeypox that was going to start on May 15th of 2022. And then, of course, May of 2022 in real life, we were hearing all about monkeypox. So I'm very concerned here because they're talking about children this time, dude. What do you think?
Yeah, that was Nuclear Threat Initiative, I believe, that did that one on the monkeypox. That was that would have been what I think that was 2021 last year, and then they predicted May monkeypox, and that didn't really pick up for whatever reason, intentional or not. There was no monkeypox pandemic, and suffice to say that. I don't think I'm going to be traveling or leaving Mexico in early 2023 because just in case, you know, as it was before, you know, Event 201 in October 2019, and then, you know, January, February, everything starts getting locked down. I got stranded in Kazakhstan. March 2020, I was supposed to fly back to Mexico, and literally you could not. The trains in Kazakhstan were shut. U.S. border was shut. Nobody in or out. Planes were canceled. And so I think I'm going to wait it out early 2023 because at this point, like anything goes. And they are so open and in your face right now with this catastrophic contagion. It's just unbelievable. It's like they don't care. I think because they're getting close, to collecting all of the rings. Is it like in Lord of the Rings? You know, I think they're what, that's why they're acting so brazenly. We're in that moment where, you know, the villain is about to achieve, become all powerful. And so they have to show their face. I have no idea what to expect. I mean, I'm hoping this was, you know, this meeting passes and nothing comes of it, but, we're talking, you know, people are talking about just yesterday, we've got, you know, the bat flu, COVID, the bird flu. I mean, here in Jalisco, in Mexico, they just killed a bunch of chickens, or they vaxxed like a bunch of chickens because of the bird flu. And they're talking about the camel flu. And now the hellhound, the dog flu. I mean, give me a break, Ruckus.
I've got the media flu. I think that's the problem here. The Bill Gates flu. Let's just call it what it is, right? So the other problem with this is that now I hope people out there understand why there are these weird conspiracy theories surrounding Bill Gates. It's because he runs around doing these things. And then there's all this weird stuff, dude. I think I sent you this in the notes about this story. But when you look at this, the fictitious illness is named Severe Epidemic Enterovirus Respiratory Syndrome 2025. They call it SERS. But if you look at it, it's technically SEERS, S-E-E-R-S. And, you know, what's the definition of a seer, right? Technically, one of the definitions is one to whom divine revelations are made, prophet, a person who sees or foretells future events. I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. It's really creepy when you think about it. And I wonder if this one is just a total troll. They like, maybe they, you know, after the first, you know, the plandemic there, as I like to call it, during 2020 and all that, maybe that was like, they said, okay, good. Let's take some notes here so we can plan for the next one. And probably their biggest concerns that they needed to address is the fact that, yeah, COVID-19, like, who died really technically of COVID-19? It had like a huge survivability rate compared to things like the flu, right? So that was a problem. So of course this one, oh, look, this one has a higher fatality rate than COVID-19. How nudge, nudge, wink, wink, how convenient. And the other problem was like COVID-19 did not hardly ever affect children. And they've been pushing the jabs now for the kids. So, oh, look at that. This other one that they're talking about disproportionately randomly seems to be targeting kids and young people, which are exactly the people that COVID-19 completely missed. I'm sorry. I call complete BS on this. So if we start to hear about a new disease that matches this, I hope everyone joins me by going out in the streets and screaming as loud as you can, trying to warn everybody that this is just complete BS.
Yeah, they might use the any adverse events as cover or just try to ram through more of the same. I mean, I still see people wearing masks. Today, we are just so gullible. People, I don't know what to say. Well, anyways, we'll check in with you again soon, Ruckus, and we'll be right back after this break.
TNT Radio's Jason Olborn.
The integrity of news reporting is making a seismic shift away from the mainstream. We're improving every day, and they are now openly telling lies, and the cover-ups like what's happened with Twitter are now being lifted. But Twitter can only be the trigger or the catalyst at the start. Russia is poised to draw out the next big reveal. As we now know, NATO is out of money and weapons. The virus narrative is crumbling, and the origins of COVID story is now a headline, even appearing in the New York Post. Musk and Trump faked their fallout back in 2017, and odds on that Elon Musk and Neuralink technology is connected to the entire Q movement. That would have been the setup back then. Like Jared Kushner is the setup for the FBI to raid Mar-a-Lago to fake another rift. And of course, nothing was found in that. It was all a big hoax that forced the FBI to show their political hand.
Jason Olborn and Jason Q Citizen on TNT Radio.
Let's take advantage of the freedoms that we have while we have them to advance the kingdom's objective to be salt and light.
Freedom is hard. Election security involves you, involves the voters.
This election for people of faith is vital that we see a change, because the war against Christians is at an all-time high.
Transparency is the key not only to having honest elections, but to maintaining public trust in those elections.
Our ability to vote is not being withheld from us. No one's trying to stop you from voting.
The one place the American people can have a say is at the ballot box. That's why the Democrats and the far left are working so hard to get rid of all election integrity.
We cannot let our elections be anything but transparent. It is at the very heart of freedom in a free society.
And if we lose America, I mean, it's all over, because the world has looked to America for hope.
Free and fair at salemnow.com.
Every public classroom should have a camera where parents can watch and listen during class. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
All right. CJ Kilmer is joining me. He's the host of the Dangerous History podcast dedicated to sharing history that the establishment would rather you not know, so you can learn the past and thereby better understand the present and prepare for the future, as Winston Churchill once said. So let me read his Twitter bio. I like it. Dangerous History podcaster, former academic historian gone rogue, proud citizen of the Republic of Florida. And his website, dangeroushistorypodcast.com. You can subscribe to it there and find him on Twitter at Kilmer. That's two L's. Kilmer, CJ. Welcome to TNT Radio, CJ.
Hey, thanks for inviting me on.
Thanks for coming on. I like your work. And let me just read a quick from your About Me page where it says, "It was a long, slow slog, but over the next 8 years, the Dangerous History podcast gradually grew in listenership and profitability until in August of 2022, thanks to the support of listeners, CJ was able to resign from his teaching day job in order to do the podcast and other independent content creation projects full-time," end quote. And it's funny because I'm a history major and former history teacher and professor, just like yourself. My manner of teaching had been politically incorrect, so I got into trouble a number of times over the years. But I have a decade of successful teaching under my belt, from elite schools in Kazakhstan to Mexico, where I'm speaking to you from now. But I really prefer doing what I'm doing now. There's more freedom, reaching more people, and actually a higher level of discussion. And like you, I made the transition from teaching to radio and podcasting somewhere between August 2021 to spring 2022. And everyone loves a great success story. So maybe tell us a bit about your transition from the real world to the metaverse, where you're now fighting, global tyranny virtually.
Yes. Yeah, so I was in formal academia for 22 years, counting my time as a student, a graduate student, and then as a professor. And I really didn't run into too much trouble. I guess I was kind of sort of flew under the radar, and I was at a school for most of that time that wasn't really big on like policing, the ideological content and that sort of stuff. And so I was able to get away with some pretty radical stuff that maybe people at like, more fancy universities would get in trouble for and get noticed for. But it's still frustrating in terms of like, at least where I was at basically a community college, and I'm teaching the same handful of intro level history classes again and again and again. And I try and insert as much, cool, dangerous history type stuff in there as I could, but there's still limits on what you can do just because of time. And, you got to teach like 200 years of American history. You can't spend hours and hours and hours and hours talking just about the CIA's dirty deeds the whole time, So, I finally got to the point where, and in some ways, all of the COVID insanity of the last few years was kind of some of the last straws. And, I'm in Florida, so I didn't have to worry about like vax mandates or anything like that. But still, the colleges here had a fair amount of leeway to do things for quite a while, like making first all and then eventually just most of the classes online, and other annoying things like there was a mask mandate for close to a year when you were on campus. And, just really, really depressing to me, really ruined all of the parts of teaching in that setting that I liked. And so I finally got to a point over last summer where, I was starting to, after some severe mental health issues, mostly related to depression, I was finally starting to get kind of better somewhat over the course of last summer. And I was looking ahead to returning for another academic year in August. And I was like, I just can't do it. I'm terrified of what's going to happen. All the progress in recovering my mental health over the course of the summer, what's going to happen when I go back to teaching and still have to, deal with this, all the problems. And so I wish I had thought of it earlier, but I finally had the idea of doing a crowdfunding campaign to put together a little bit of a lump sum to tide me over for at least the first few months of lost income and benefits, because my job didn't, pay well. Teaching at a community college in a fairly small town in North Florida, didn't pay great, paid basically what a high school teacher gets paid, but it paid steady and, you know, it had benefits and whatever like that. So, my Indiegogo campaign was successful, long story short, and that gave me, either the courage or the, foolhardiness, depending on what side of the Aristotle, divide I fall on, to resign. And, you know, I'm sure I shocked the heck out of my administrators. I had always done pretty well there. I'd always gotten good evaluations from students and administrators. I didn't have problems with people, that I was working with for the most part, but, I walked away and, you know, time will tell if, it was simultaneously, you know, exhilarating, liberating, and also terrifying, to do that, walking away from a steady job that I had held for 15 years. And we'll see if I was brave or if I was foolhardy, whether I have to go be a janitor somewhere in a few months to keep a roof over my family's head. I hope not. But it certainly has been liberating to just, you know, really take the gloves off and really be able to devote all those hours I used to have to spend commuting to work, teaching classes, grading papers, dealing with all the stupid, you know, meetings and all that kind of nonsense that you deal with in a conventional teaching position, you know, pointless meetings that just waste your time, dealing with stupid student issues, you know, that kind of thing, a student challenging a grade you gave them, or you bust a student for cheating and they claim they weren't cheating, even though the evidence is overwhelming. So anyway, I'm happy to be rid of all that. And I'm happy to be like a completely rogue historian now.
Yeah. And, you know, no regrets. We can always go back, to teaching, although for me, I taught at one of the best paying options in Mexico. And it's funny because I was hired as a foreigner, and foreigners get paid usually more than locals. And in the meanwhile, you know, after I left, I became a Mexican national. And so if I went back, I would be paid as a Mexican and much lower because they have adjusted salaries. So that wouldn't be cool. And I've had sort of hiccups along the way. You know, I had my biggest in 2020, biggest YouTube interview ever taken down, 300,000 views and climbing, killed by YouTube. And then I started a Patreon in 2020. You start to grow it. I mean, you know how it is. And then I get terminated for Patreon. And then, okay, make a new website with a membership option with PayPal. People start subscribing because it's all about building that momentum. And then in April of this year, I'm banned from PayPal. And it's just like every time I'm starting and stopping, and the system just keeps giving me a hard time. But we're going to have to jump to our news break. CJ, we'll be right back.
What brings you here?
News entirely.
TNT Radio News.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. A former Libyan intelligence official accused of making the bomb that brought down Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, appeared Monday in a federal court charged with an act of international terrorism. The former CEO of failed cryptocurrency firm FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, has been arrested in the Bahamas at the request of the U.S. government. Serious gas shortages across the EU are now expected next year as well, according to Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
The common housefly. Caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa. Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
So I see over, again, we're talking to CJ Kilmer, and do subscribe to his fantastic podcast, DangerousHistoryPodcast.com, and find him on Twitter at KilmerCJ. That's KILLMERCJ. And I see we've had some of the same guests over the years. I've interviewed Tom Secker way back when and Scott Horton as well. And let's talk CIA dirty tricks, as you said. You know, my worldview when it comes to history and politics is that it all pretty much consists of conspiracy and deep politics and a lot of false flag operations. The establishment history we're given often is merely scratching the surface or a big misdirection. I mean, you know, like Tonkin Gulf, you know, you mean U.S. ships were never hit by the Vietnamese and the LBJ officially launched the war over nothing? Or you know, you take Coretta Scott King, who launched a civil court case in 1999, which got the verdict that the U.S. government killed her husband, MLK. So you sort of get what I'm saying. And so But, you know, CJ, what's sort of your worldview or frame or lens when it comes to studying, understanding, and explaining history?
Yeah, well, you know, I've kind of changed the various labels I put on myself over the years. I'm kind of like an anarchist, broadly defined, in the sense that I'm always just extremely skeptical of any kind of power, especially if it's concentrated power, especially if it's concentrated power that is able to operate under a veil of secrecy, especially if it's concentrated power that also is able to wield massive propaganda power. And so, you know, that typically means governments, especially military and intelligence parts of the government, and also domestic, you know, surveillance and law enforcement parts of governments, and as well as their corporate allies. And, you know, the line between corporations and states has always been way more blurry and permeable than a lot of kind of standard, for lack of a better term, autistic libertarians, you know, the types who will say, well, you know, whatever Twitter does, Facebook does, you know, Bill Gates does, they're private companies, so, you know, it's fine. The line between corporations and state has always been very, very blurry and messy and sometimes non-existent. And if anything, it just keeps getting more that way every day in our own time. So, yeah, my overall view is I'm always skeptical of whoever's wielding the power, especially if they've got things like secrecy, you know, the ability to deploy deadly force, the ability to run massive propaganda apparatuses. And obviously the CIA is by no means the only, you know, agency or institution that fits that description, but they're certainly, you know, one of the most dangerous ever since they were created in the 1940s or even before that, the OSS. I also, in some of my work, have keyed in quite a bit as well on the Office of Naval Intelligence, or ONI, which is actually technically America's oldest intelligence agency. It actually goes back, if I remember right, to the 1880s. It's like literally 75 years older than the CIA. And it's also older than Army intelligence, which came in a few decades after naval intelligence. And if you think about how many of America's wars where either like one major part of precipitating the war or the major part of precipitating the war is naval in nature, right? And part of it has to do with, you know, the United States is rarely threatened in and around its home territory, particularly the lower 48. So, you know, if you want to go provoke someone into a fight, obviously odds are your Navy is going to be how you do that. And then I think it's also the fact that ONI literally is the oldest intelligence agency in American history. And so, yeah, think about, you know, Pearl Harbor, the Gulf of Tonkin, you know, all sorts of other different incidents and provocations. And I would go back even further. I did years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago, I did an episode on the USS Maine blowing up in Havana in 1898. And I put together what I think is a pretty strong case to at least suspect that the Maine was actually a false flag, and that at least some of the people involved with it were ONI operatives. And so I traced some of the personnel who were involved with the Maine, either, you know, leading up to its explosion or involved with the initial cover-up after it. And, you know, you may know, and some of your listeners may know, that the government, the U.S. government's official initial, you know, story was the Maine blew up because the Spanish, you know, planted a bomb or a mine or something and blew it up, right? The forensic evidence for that is pretty much non-existent. And the political evidence is also non-existent. At that very time when the Maine blew up, the Spanish government was bending over backwards to try and, you know, ease tensions with the U.S. government in order to avoid America getting involved against Spain in Cuba. And so why on earth in those circumstances would the Spanish then blow up an American battleship in Havana Harbor when it stops by to visit? Like, that's just ridiculous. And so then after a little while, once the Spanish-American War got rolling, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and all those guys got their war, and I think he was personally involved with it, probably, if it was a false flag. Then after a little while, more and more people, even in the establishment, the evidence is so overwhelming that it wasn't the Spanish blowing it up on purpose or anything like that. And so then the narrative becomes, and has been ever since, in most places, well, the main blew up because of a horrible accident. You know, there was a flaw in its design and accidentally some, you know, sparks or whatever from the coal, because it was a coal-powered ship, hit the powder magazine and blew up. And that's certainly possible, and it's certainly more likely than the Spanish doing it. But in that episode, I think it was my episode 160, Dangerous History Podcast episode 160, and the title was something like "Remember the Maine and the Pageantry of U.S. Aggression." And I make the argument that the Maine probably was a false flag, that the Office of Naval Intelligence, as well as certain Cuban agents that wanted America to get involved, were probably involved with blowing up the Maine as well. But my view is the accident narrative is ultimately a limited hangout. It's like the next fallback position. Once it's, you know, totally indefensible to keep saying that the Spanish did it, then the next retreat is, well, it was an accident. And, you know, Teddy Roosevelt was just a little bit overzealous, as were some others, to want to pin it on the Spanish. They just made a mistake of being a little bit too over-aggressive, you know, but they weren't deliberately being dishonest or whatever. And there's so many parallels to a lot of future, you know, excuses for the United States government to get into wars, where it's like somebody high up in the government, or a cabal usually, whether it's the neocons and, you know, after 9/11 or Teddy Roosevelt and guys like that in the 1890s, a cabal of guys in the government wants a war that the public, you know, really doesn't care about, isn't interested in. And so they start to place, you know, requirements on whatever regime they're targeting. Hey, you have to give in to these demands that we have. And then a lot of the time, the regime that's being targeted starts to concede many of the demands, or say, yeah, we don't want America to invade us. So, you know what? Yeah, we'll give in to 80% of your demands. And when that happens, or sometimes even 100% of your demands. And when that happens, then the people trying to engineer the war will simply go, well, actually, we've got these 15 other demands, you know, and they're demands that they know that the other side simply can't accept. And then usually around that time, as that's playing out in the diplomatic sphere, some sort of a shady incident will happen, like the Maine blowing up, something like that. And anyway, there's interesting parallels looking back at the Maine. There's parallels as well to the Ukraine, Russo-Ukraine war right now, where obviously the Ukrainians are desperate to try and pull America into the war in an overt, full-blown fashion. And you can see, you know, Zelensky coming out immediately after the missile killed two farmers in Poland or whatever. He comes out right away, even though he had to have known that wasn't a Russian missile. But that's what he comes out with. And he's like asking the American government to unleash, you know, World War III because of this. And to me, that's very similar to, you know, I believe that there were some Cuban agents trying to pull America into their revolutionary war against Spain and Cuba at the time. And so they very likely, in my opinion, had involvement in blowing up the Maine as a way to, you know, pull America in.
Yeah, there's so much fascinating stuff here. It's the first time you mentioned the ONI. I got a mini crash course. We got a mini crash course now on the ONI. So if anyone wants, you know, that's definitely something that I'm going to research in the future. And I've got the book Day of Deceit regarding Pearl Harbor. I think it's Robert Stinnett, the yes. author. And I assigned, I think, a chapter or two when I was teaching at the undergraduate level here in Mexico. And we had a friendly relationship with the U.S. Embassy here in Mexico. And sometimes, you know, I'd invite them, or the IR department would invite them to give guest lectures. And I invited a lady from the U.S. Embassy, you know, State Department here in Mexico, to give a lecture. And I had not planned this. I mean, I just gave a chapter, you know, reading from Day of Deceit, basically pointing out that Pearl Harbor was in a way a false flag. And this is what I learned in Geneva as well in my graduate studies of IR in Switzerland, one of my professors, that basically the U.S. pushed Japan into a corner that would force them to react, you know, by cutting oil, like a list of eight steps that the U.S. did that would kind of force Japan into this position. And there were declassified documents that said U.S. wanted Japan to attack the U.S., which then could be used, you know, as a pretext. And then my entire class was mixed of Mexicans and international students. They went to town on this person from the U.S. Embassy, which was, you know, very nice, but it was just something to watch where they have to stick to the official narrative. You know, if you work at the State Department, you cannot. I mean, I know people who were not, you know, good Americans that were denied jobs because of their profile that was a bit dissident. I mean, you really have to toe the line, even if you're lying through your teeth. And the students just went to town, and I just really felt bad. That's not what I was going for. But CJ, we're going to have to jump to our break, and then we can continue the conversation. Again, everyone subscribe to the Dangerous History Podcast. It's dangeroushistorypodcast.com. You can support with Patreon there, and follow CJ on Twitter at Kilmer. CJ, we'll be right back on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Oh, just when you think you've heard it all from the climate nut jobs, comes a piece in the Washington Post headlined, "Should You Not Have Kids Because of Climate Change? It's Complicated." And it's by climate zeitgeist reporter Shannon Osaka. It starts with the story of a woman who has a 13-year-old daughter, and while deciding whether or not to have kids, she couldn't shake the feeling that by giving birth, she might be doing something bad for the Earth. "I wanted to have a child," she said, "but I was also looking at the planet and thinking, well, what kind of future will we have if there's more of the same?" She thought about the diapers, the party favors, the toys, the billions of tons of carbon emissions warming the planet every year. And she's not alone. A 2021 Pew Research Center survey of childless adults showed 5% of those said it was because of climate change and the environment. And now the question of whether to have kids is shifting from fears over what children will do to the climate to fears over what the climate will do to them. In other words, it's become an illness that takes on many forms, and it is contagious. Here's some advice. Have kids, lots of them, and find something real to worry about. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Do citizens make decisions based on evidence and reason? Or are they manipulated by behavioral economists applying nudge theory? In 1992, the Rockefeller-controlled Russell Sage Foundation launched the Behavioral Economics Roundtable. In 2008, two members of the roundtable, Cass Sustain and Richard Thaler, co-authored the book Nudge, which led to widespread government adoption of nudge theory through the Behavioral Insights Team. Also known as the Nudge Unit, launched in the United Kingdom, the Behavioral Insights Team now has offices worldwide, including in Canada, Latin America, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore. The Nudge Unit boasts to have trained 20,000 civil servants and practitioners in behavioral insights. Supported by taxpayer funding, subtle messaging techniques nudge populations to normalize behaviors and attitudes deemed appropriate by nameless, faceless bureaucrats. The Nudge Unit plays on people's fears and guilt. It promises rewards for compliance in its projects, such as boosting vaccination rates and reducing energy consumption.
Twitter Files confirms the Biden campaign colluded with big tech to shut down reporting on Hunter Biden's laptop. Impeach Joe Biden now. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And we're back on our final segment with CJ Kilmer, host of the Dangerous History Podcast, former teacher, professor, and I highly recommend the podcast. And maybe you mentioned Ukraine, and maybe to get your thoughts on some current events as well. I know sometimes you touch on them also, and we've got a World War III situation seemingly budding in Ukraine, and as well as South China Sea with China, a Great Depression 2.0, a faceless and nameless dystopian technocracy taking over our governments around the world, a rising eugenicist biosecurity state. A lot of what we see today, I mean, for the last 2 years, I've been saying it's the 1930s all over again. It's really like a rhyme and a repeat of history. It's nothing new under the sun. Things, they're just rearing their ugly heads once again. And what are some current events that are really sort of bugging you or fascinating you?
Well, everything that you just mentioned, you know, a lot of lingering effects and hangovers of the COVIDian regime. And then the one thing I would also throw in there that you didn't mention just now, but I'm sure you're probably not a fan of either, is the whole woke, movement and how that's just like dominating so many institutions of supposed education and supposed, you know, arts and entertainment and whatever like that, and even things like corporate advertising. And I think there's sort of two levels to that. You know, there's the level of powerful institutions, whether they're corporations, the Pentagon, the CIA, you know, tons of others, they're jumping on the wokeista bandwagon, you know, I think in many cases cynically, to use it as a shield and a distraction, right? So, you know, it's a basically a cost-free way that like a Wall Street investment bank or the CIA or whatever can be like, oh no, we're progressive and, you know, humanitarian. Like, look at this, we put up a rainbow flag. You know, doesn't really cost them anything, and they can go keep on doing whatever crimes they're doing. And now they have cover, and they could appoint a few, you know, non-white faces to the board of directors or whatever and go, look at how woke we are. And so on the one hand, you know, I kind of see that as being cynically used by those institutions in and out of the state. But I also see it as something that is, you know, more deeply disturbing in a bunch of ways. And I've done a lot of episodes over the past year or two, you know, talking about the effects, sometimes myself, sometimes with a guest, talking about how this has affected things like movies and television and other things that, you know, you could say, oh, they're throwaway pop culture, but, you know, people today, more of their worldview is shaped by movies and TV and things like that than it is shaped by, you know, reading books, or, you know, by their religion, if they have one, or by, you know, their culture. Like, their culture is their movies. And so if you can have all this woke propaganda, which often includes like explicitly anti nuclear family stuff and, you know, all sorts of things worked into there, that these things are more damaging than a lot of people realize in the long run. And I think about like the messages being pumped into the brains of a lot of younger people these days from things like, you know, woke Hollywood. It's telling them things like, you know, by doing away with the traditional hero's journey narratives that used to show for 5,000 years or more, you know, hero's journey narratives showed people coming up against adversity and having to overcome it and having to improve themselves and learn. And that's all being replaced with like these victim narratives of woke media, where, you know, the protagonist is already perfect and awesome and great and good at everything and wonderful. And their only problem is that, you know, some of the people around them don't understand yet how perfect and awesome they are. And think about the message that sends to young people. It's like, it's like helping to nudge them to be more narcissistic. And it's disempowering and takes away their agency in a way, because it's telling young people, you're already perfect and great and wonderful, and the only reason you might have problems is because some annoying jerk, you know, doesn't acknowledge how great and awesome and perfect you already are. To me, it's a much better message to tell young people, like, you can be great and awesome and you know, successful and powerful and efficacious, but you have to work for it. You have to try. You have to learn from other people. You know, when you're an 18-year-old, you don't know much about the world, even if you are really intelligent. And so, you know, have some humility and maybe try to learn from people that are more knowledgeable and wiser than you. So, yeah, that's the one thing I would add probably to the list of, you know, which I would totally agree with, of the various wars and conflicts and the economic problems and, you know, the hangover of a lot of the tyranny still hanging on in like a ratchet effect of the COVIDian regime. And it's been, you know, kind of disturbing but obvious to me watching the last few years of sort of cultural history, that COVIDianism and wokeism, for lack of better terms, are essentially both kind of like fundamentalist religious cults. And they're cults that are distinct, and yet they overlap with each other in like a Venn diagram to a large extent. So, you know, not everybody, but a lot of the people who are hardcore COVID hysterics are also hardcore on the woke bandwagon, and vice versa. And so to me, to look at those things as like true believer mass movements, in the sense of like Eric Hoffer's book, The True Believer, and to think of those as sort of like moral panics and, you know, almost kind of like 21st century witch hunts in a way. That's also kind of disturbing too. And I don't know if these institutions that have been cynically amping up all that stuff, you know, Wall Street, the CIA, the Pentagon, the corporate news media, quote unquote, Hollywood and entertainment. I don't know even if the people that are in there are using this ideology cynically, I don't know if they can always control it. You know, it sort of reminds me in a way of in the early rise of the Nazis to power in Germany in the 30s, a lot of more kind of like old school conservative German, you know, politicians and industrialists, they saw the Nazis as like, oh, these are these radical yahoos or whatever, but we can kind of co-opt them and we can use them and we can sort of keep them under control and, you know, use them for our political benefit without letting them go too crazy. And it didn't take very long for the Nazis to sort of, you know, like Frankenstein's monster, get up off the table and start doing stuff. And next thing you know, they're in the driver's seat. And so I do worry some of these, what I would consider kind of almost cult-like movements, will they get out of control even of these more cynical institutions that have been sponsoring them in recent years to a large extent?
Speaking of cult-like, I've got a guest on tomorrow from New York who was actually in a modern-day cult, Manhattan cult. So that'll be interesting. But yeah, you know, when in my younger years, I tried to do like diaries and journaling, and it's not for me. I can't do journaling, but I did Peace Corps in Mongolia, and I thought about, you know, because your memory forgets. And back then it was less, you know, in the 2000s, we didn't really have smartphones and it was more difficult to document your experience. And I thought, you know, for my future kid, at that time I was just single and now I got kids. And so I was just seeing into the future for posterity, you know, to record my experiences. And I realize I'm just so young and inexperienced. I don't have much to say. And even now it's like, I still feel like I don't have, even though I do all this podcasting and radio, it's just like so many people are coming out with so many great books. I mean, I think we're overloaded with information, even good information. Like I didn't feel like this way a couple of years ago. I mean, are you getting that same feeling where just in the last year or two or three, it's just, I'm overwhelmed. Like I can't follow the stuff I want to follow anymore. It's just too much. Yeah. Any thoughts on information overload?
Oh yeah, that's definitely a thing. And I've struggled with it. I've had to repeatedly over the past few years, kind of consciously reduce and limit my news consumption, in part because of mental health. You know, I have clinical depression basically, and you know, spending too much time consuming the news, especially the last few years, it really doesn't help that situation. And then also it gets in the way, just for me personally. I mean, there's plenty of great researchers and podcasters and so forth that focus on, you know, current events. My show, obviously, I bring up current events when they're relevant to something I'm covering, but, you know, it ultimately is more of a history podcast. And so, you know, I'm more likely to talk about something that happened at least a few decades ago, if not, you know, a century or more ago. And so I've had to also kind of like roll back my current events news consumption just to free up my time and energy so that, for example, I can go to work on my next episode about Woodrow Wilson or whatever it is. You know, I'm going back to the roots of a lot of these problems and where they came from. Man, does a lot of it go back to Woodrow Wilson. And even there, I deal with information overload just because it's so easy between the internet and, you know, online book sellers and whatever. It's so much easier than it used to be to access things like history books, articles, primary sources, all that. And so, yeah, I struggle with that too. It's one of the biggest things probably that slows down the big multi-hour narrative solo history episodes that I do periodically, which are always my most popular, by the way. But the biggest time suck for me on that is just simply going through piles of sources to try to put together good information, figure out what I think is true and false, figure out what I think about something, and then put it together into a coherent, you know, sort of a narrative. Right now, I'm in the midst of, I was working on it for hours earlier today, part 10 in my ongoing Woodrow Wilson series. And this one is going to be all about Woodrow Wilson and his racism and all of the things he said and did over his career that were, you know, racist and all that. And, you know, it's going to be hours and hours long. And I'm just going through like piles of books and articles and primary sources. So yeah, I deal with information overload with current events. And then I step away from it to work on a history show. And then I get overloaded there too. So yeah, I can completely sympathize with that, you know, but there's kind of no shortcut that I'm aware of if you want to separate the wheat from the chaff as far as your research.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. And I'm finding more and more it's good to step away. You have this, you know, the fear of missing out, but at the end of the day, I don't think you will miss out too much from the news cycle. And it's just better to read and get that foundational. Again, history repeats. As you were talking about, if you understand the template, the mechanism of what our governments do, what they did back then, you'll recognize it again. Today, we got a minute left. CJ, if you want to tell us again, best places to find you online, to find your podcast, to follow it, and to support you.
Sure, absolutely. DangerousHistoryPodcast.com will take you to my website. You can also just search Dangerous History Podcast or Dangerous History, even wherever you consume your podcast, whether it's the Apple Podcast app, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever the heck people are using these days. You'll find it there, and you can support my work on an ongoing basis via either Patreon or Subscribestar. I've got a few other ways you can contribute on my website. My Indiegogo campaign is still live if somebody wants to chip in there and get some of the benefits that I have offered there. And yeah, I've got almost 250 episodes and 30 bonus episodes to the supporters of my show currently. And I'm currently working on part 10.
CJ, we're out of time. Thank you so much, CJ. DangerousHistoryPodcast.com. I'll be right back after this break.